listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 35th installment of our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR. And we're going to be speaking today about actually a Western phenomenon, anti-Soviet propaganda. And it's relevant even today, isn't it?
Yes, it is, isn't it, Don? Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'd say it's the most relevant thing that's happened in a long time. All you have to do is flip through the news channels, and it's been Russia, 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 Russia all over the place.
Yes.
Evil baby killers. That's what they are today.
Yeah, I hadn't planned to say this, but I'm going to say it. I think it was Lloyd George who said that Russia, Bolshevik or otherwise, was a threat to the British Empire.
Of course, yep.
And now it is a threat to the American Empire. It's progress.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, so, you know, the Soviet Union was certainly a threat to the British Empire in that, among other things, ideologically, it was anti-imperialist, and
exactly
that's the sin.
And I think it was mentioned. They knew very well that. Well, ideologically, yes, and also they provided the Soviet Union provided support and training and weapons, etc., to the colonies.
Yep. National liberation struggle. So, yeah. Okay. Well, so let's look at some of the, let's see, what would the word be? Some of the archetypes, for example, that have been established, to use the term that's a favorite of a friend of mine. The legend of Stalin.
Archetypal myths.
Yes, exactly. Like Stalin as Dracula. The communist Dracula. Bruh, bruh.
Perfect. It's a Slav from the East.
That's right.
Okay, so today the topic is anti-Soviet propaganda and how to be objective about it.
Right.
It ties in with what we were talking about in former programs, in the last few programs, which was about Trotsky, who became an anti-Soviet propagandist in the end.
Yeah, the anti-Soviet propagandist in many ways, because he was the one that was pitching to the left and fractured the left.
Yeah, it's the left that's damaging Trotsky, Khrushchev, Gorbachev. Yeltsin doesn't count.
He's not left.
But you know, those are the people that are the most dangerous.
Yeah, Yeltsin was left at last call. That's all. That's all his left was. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Let's go. So, anti-Soviet propaganda. So, preamble. I think this is an important topic because we, the people in the West, are educated. In fact, we are conditioned to loathe the Soviet Union. And just about everybody hates it in the West.
It's an evil empire.
I beg your pardon?
It's an evil empire.
Yeah. The Trotskys hate it because Stalin, not Trotsky, built the Soviet Union. The Social Democrats hate it because it was revolutionary and rejected capitalism. The capitalists hate it, obviously, because it is the antagonist. The mass media hates it, and it is owned by the capitalist. The schools, the colleges, and the universities, the publisher, and the whole hegemonic apparatus hates it. The ideological orientation of Western education is, of course, not to turn out communists or socialists. So the curriculum and the research are directed towards sustaining and replicating the status quo. So that's a reality we have to face, those of us that are outside this massive Western anti-Soviet sentiment. I don't think I'm exaggerating.
No.
So we in the West have a hard time being objective about the Soviet Union. So let's see what objectivity entails. So how do we... what is objectivity? Actually, it's a scientific method of distrusting the self. It is a process of becoming aware of, to identify, and then to doubt one's own preconceived ideas. One must be automatically suspicious of evidence that tends to confirm one's own preconceived ideas. This is very difficult to do. I notice it in myself every day. Everything that confirms my own predisposition, I immediately latch onto. And then I have to stop myself and say, who says this? What is the source? What is the interest? And I have to actually stop myself and examine everything. It's a very difficult thing to do. And it needs training, and it's like learning a foreign language. So, so when we read, let's say 1969, the publication of Robert Conquest, The Great Terror, where he, the most important page in the book is where he says that Stalin killed 20 to 30 million people. That at a certain point, 60 million working age Russians were in the camps. 60 million working age, 25 million working age, I got the thing mixed up. 25 million working age people were in the camps out of 60 million working people. I mean, these things, I wasn't going to talk about Conquest now it's just identifying the myths. But when we read that book, 1969, Robert Conquest, The Great Terror, or 2010, Timothy Snyder, Bloodlands, you know, we know that those are lies, but others should not use these books as confirmation of their preconceived ideas. Otherwise, the myths go on.
Right.
So, eight myths. The collectivization of agriculture to examine. Eight myths to examine for what they say and what the reality is. So, number one, collectivization of agriculture. The famine of 1932-33, which is the so-called Holodomor. Number three, the Great Terror, or Yezoshvina. Number four, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Number five, the alleged invasion of Poland in September 1939. Number six, the Katyn massacre. Number seven, the Warsaw Uprising. And number eight, Stalin's anti-Semitism. These are the major myths that right. are then recycled in Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands, which is a very, a very influential work of anti-Sovietism, which has been translated in 20 languages. I mean, he's an official regime intellectual. So that's, why did we need a book in 2010 that picks up all these myths again, when actually the Soviet Union was dissolved? Well, because for some reason because it serves the cause of anti-socialism, but also what Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands did was to equate Hitler and Stalin, and to simply nullify any possibility of the renewal of socialism. So let's look at collectivization of agriculture, and together with the famine of 1932-33 in Ukraine, the so-called Holodomor. Now, what happened in the famine of 1932-33, two explanations are offered. The Ukrainian nationalists say, well, the Stalin government withheld grain from Ukrainian peasants in order to export it, and deliberately starved Ukrainian peasants because they were striving for independence. Now, the Holodomor myth, which is patterned after the Holocaust, originated in the Ukrainian diaspora. That would be Canada and the United States. And actually, as far as I can tell, that term emerged in the 1980s during the Reagan's a new assault against the Soviet Union as the evil empire. So the Holodomor is a recent invention, that name, and originated in Harvard and, or landed in Harvard and was elaborated. Now, the diaspora were Ukrainians who had fought alongside the Nazis in Galicia and fled to the West with the Nazi armies, the German armies in retreat when the Red Army invaded when the Red Army reconquered the places that had been occupied. The second explanation for the famines, that support the myths of the evil Soviet government. The second one, it is argued that due to collectivization and excessive state grain requisition, which led to mismanagement and peasant rebellion and to famine and starvation. So that collectivization led to famine and starvation because of mismanagement and appropriation of excessive grain. And this, unfortunately, is the position of the Russian government today. Now, neither of these two really are borne by primary evidence that scholars have been unearthing since the opening of the Russian archives. In fact, there was a decline in exports, but it is estimated that by scholars who are studying that even a complete cessation of export would not have prevented the famine, because the harvest of 1932 made famine inevitable. So the reality is that collectivization put an end to famine in the Soviet Union, except for a famine in 1946-47, which was due to environmental causes and, of course, the disruption of the war. So what really happened? What is the counter-explanation? Well, during the famine of 1928-29, 1928 is the beginning of the first five-year plan of Stalin's five-year plan. So there was a famine in 1928-29, and this convinced the leaders that Soviet agriculture had to be changed. They attributed the historic and endemic famines of the Soviet Union to agricultural backwardness. The collectivization of agriculture was designed to end the cycle of famines. It was a reform. It was a significant improvement in the security of the lives of the peasantry, 81%, 80 over of the whole population, but also of the whole population. So from 1929-1939, the Soviet government spent billions on agriculture to increase food production using modern and reliable methods, mechanization, and patterning their methods by studying U.S. agriculture in the West, and had experts come and from America to instruct them.
Yep. And you know what's interesting about them coming from America, by the way, they were leaving the dirty 30s, you know, the Dust Bowl. You had, you know, huge chunks of agricultural sections of the United States were under the condition of drought. The topsoil had been deeply plowed and damaged. The agricultural sector was devastated in the United States. You had millions of people driven off their farms because they couldn't pay their mortgages or grow crops because of the Dust Bowl. They would have black blizzards, as they call them, all the way into New York City and Washington from you know, soil that was airborne from the Midwest. These are the same people that wanted to lecture others.
Say that again, lizards?
Black blizzards or black rollers. Ooh. Here in the United States. There were choking billows of dust that traveled as far as the East Coast, Washington and New York, among others, reducing visibility in the plains to 3 feet or less. And this was the soil and the dirt just being airborne because it was cut loose because of the farming practices prior and the drought.
Yes. And but didn't Roosevelt put together studies in agriculture?
Yep, they did.
When did it turn?
Well, Roosevelt, during the first 100 days of in 1933, jumped on the soil conservation and some other things. Because mm-hmm. you had, let's see, I guess he had three waves, I think, of when this happened, and it began in the late 20s and early 30s, and it continued until like 1940, because the problem was so well established, you know, the conditions were so pervasive that it took a decade of attack. But some places were suffering this drought and these dust bowl conditions for 8, 9, 10 years.
Good heavens.
Yeah, the waves were 1934 was one wave, 1936 another, and then 1939 and 40. But really from the late 20s until 1940.
Yeah, it's interesting because I used to teach the Grapes of Wrath.
Exactly.
Which documents that
yep.
horrible disaster.
That's
the,
right. Yep.
You know.
I mean, that was a contemporaneous report. Steinbeck wrote that in 1939, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was like he's reporting, basically, you know, through that device.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, go ahead. So, yeah. So, anyway, I'm going very
kind of perfunctorily over these three, and I think we can expand later on in more details. And the third myth then is the myth of the or what has been known as the Great Terror, which is difficult to explain in short terms, but okay, I will try. The Great Terror, or the Yezovshina. Yezov was the head of the NKVD by 1937. Now, supposedly, this is the time that has come down to us as Stalin-directed mass murder of 30 million people.
Right.
But he killed 30 million, and it's now gotten to be even 100 million, people. There have been claims of that sort of outrageous number.
Which would depopulate the Soviet Union, which at the time had a population of between 150 and 200 million people. So killing 100 million, you'd probably notice.
Yes, you would notice, and then who would fight the war?
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean, so those numbers are just incredible. Let me reach for my notes if I can. Well, let me first explain. Just give a framework.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Yezhov became the head of the NKVD, and what happened, the Great Terror supposedly started in 1937, a month after the trial of Tukhachevsky. Of general of the military trial of Tukhachevsky, which found top army personnel had been involved in conspiracies with the Germans to overthrow the Soviet government, and Tukhachevsky and top army personnel were found guilty of treason and executed. So there was a, from the point of view of the Politburo, the army was not the most dependable at that point of institution. So the NKVD was the only one that they could rely on. Nevertheless, excuse me. Yezhov passed on to Stalin a telegram coming from or Western Siberia from one of the secretaries there, saying that there was insurrection and conspiracy with the Japanese, and asking for what are those called? Special powers to put these insurrections and these conspiracies down.
Right.
And in fact, the Politburo did issue permission to kill the worst and put down the rest. Hmm. Now, what happened was that for the whole year of 1937, Stalin was receiving countless numbers of reports of insurrections in the outer lands. And mass murders of innocent people did occur. But what really happened was that Yezhov himself was found guilty and confess that the object of the mass murders was to actually raise rebellions against the Soviet government. In other words, he was part of the conspiracy and was spinning out conspiracy and killing innocent people.
Right.
So I don't know how we can look at this. But all I'm asking here is that we look at these myths and become agnostic and look into it. The legend is that Stalin himself was the monster that out of his own desk, you know, was just killing willy-nilly everybody that he could. Whereas the situation that we look at in the 30s was a very difficult and tense situation and complicated. And at any rate, we cannot assign to Stalin alone the deaths, the so-called, well, the mass murder of some innocent people. We should consider that this period might be considered a second civil war. That, I mean, I'm not going to talk about the Moscow trials here, you know, because I'm afraid that we're going to run out of time.
Right.
But what about if we just simply considered that there was a state of siege within the Soviet Union, that since 1934, with the murder of Kirov, things were coming out. The army was conspiring. And this is all put down to Stalin's paranoia, to his personality. In the West, it is ascribed to the fact that he was paranoid, that none of this was happening, that he just willy-nilly started this Jacobin...
Yeah.
You know, mass murder. Now, I don't know. Let's see if I can find Great Terror 1969. Just one second.
Yeah, well, why you do that? Because it's interesting for people to note that Churchill, for example, is talking about smothering the great baboonery that was Bolshevism in its cradle in 1919. This is before Stalin and Stalinism were even identified as some kind of a threat, and even the question of bureaucratism or whatever. This was a raw reaction of imperialism, a fundamental one, to the threat of an alternate system that would not allow them to sit at the pinnacle of the state and economy, but rather would democratize them. And that is the real offense committed by the Soviet state that produced all of the things that followed from the West, including the responses that we see today.
Yeah, that's right. No, it's what I was looking for was the total, but it's difficult because the total of what the West assesses had perished in the what they call the Great Terror is about 20 million to 30 million people. And Conquest says, well, we might be able to, we should really be reasonable and raise it by 50%. So 20 to 30, 20 and then to 30. And how does he know? What are the sources for this? He actually says in his book that the reliable, that the most reliable sources are political rumor. Political rumor in high places. That is, he says that this was being talked about by political leaders, no other source.
It sounds an awful lot to me like the 17 intelligence agencies all agree that Russia did this, that, or the other thing. So, all right, well, we've got like a minute left. And one of the things that I just want to point out, maybe we can
We only have a minute left?
Yes, we do. And so what I want to do...
I was stretching it.
No, it's okay. So what I want to do is get to... I guess we can start with that next week. You know, looking at one way that you measure... Well, where your particular perspective is in relation to, say, objective reality, you know, when you're trying to move from the subjective to the objective, is to start taking account of context of the facts that you do have. And so, for example, when you're looking at international relations and things that might motivate propaganda or a false narrative or fake news. You know, if you look at the objective conditions in which this is happening, and then the interests of the parties involved, for example, in a situation where you have austerity being the only thing that can be delivered to, you know, the home audience, so to speak, a bunch of structures that have completely lost their legitimacy in the eyes of the population, no solution to that problem available, a fundamental need for a broader and deeper exploitation to sustain the model, and a rising multipolar world, you obviously have motivation to mischaracterize that particular multipolar world so that people see it as the threat rather than their salvation. I think maybe we'll start there next week because we're out of time.
Yeah.
Luciana, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. Up next, as we promised yesterday, the comments made by the permanent representative of the Syrian Arab Republic at Tuesday's UN Security Council meeting on Syria.
Thank you, Mr. President. I will give my colleagues who are about to leave the room some of my valuable time. They are afraid that I will win them in a battle of the arguments, and they do not want to hear any opposing opinions. Those who just left the room, in their statements, said that today is a sad day for the non-proliferation regime. I would like to refresh their memory and say that the violation of the non-proliferation regime is their specialty, the specialty of those Western states. The United States of America used nuclear weapons in Japan. It used chemical and biological weapons in Vietnam and enriched uranium in Iraq. France used Algerian human samples when they tested an atomic bomb in the desert of Algeria. They have actually put them in the desert against Poles, and they actually tested the first atomic French bomb. And Britain conducted all their nuclear tests in their colonies in the ocean, in the islands in the ocean. And then the ambassador of Britain says that this is a sad day. English is not my mother tongue, but I know that in Douma there is no people. There are Syrian people. There is no people of Douma. There are residents. The people is the Syrian people. I would like to quote a British author. Apart from Marx and Lenin, I will say that Shakespeare, the poet, the British poet, said one day, and I quote, "Lies defame you. Either be honest or be silent." This is back translated by the interpreter remarks. She said that Russia does not have the authority to go to Duma and establish whether chemicals have been used in Duma or not. She said that this is not the authority of our Russian friends who are actually on the ground. It's not their purview to go to Duma and to actually examine the scene. This is quite strange. Why didn't Britain say this to itself when it sent it intelligence to Khan Sheikhoun, and they gave themselves the authority to take samples from Khan Sheikhoun? This is what they claimed. They claimed this, and the French did the same. They took samples, and they took them to French and British labs without coordination with the GYM or with the FFM. This is quite a paradox. They give themselves the right that they deprive others. Anyway, Britain did sign, I think 2 weeks ago, an agreement with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia for the sale of weapons for $100 billion, which is much bigger than Al Yamama deal, to continue to kill people in Yemen and to start new wars with Syria, with Yemen, and to implicate the entire region in war that would be never-ending. This is what Britain can do. Mahatma Gandhi, he knew the British. He knew them well. He was right when he said one day, and I quote, "If there's a fight between two fishes in the ocean, you have to know that Britain started the fight between the two fishes." End of quote. The colleague from the United States said that there is only one monster that's facing the entire world today in defiance. It is the monster that financed terrorists for years in Syria. I would say this monster is the United States, Britain, and France. They sponsored terrorism in my country for 7 years. Before that, they did the same in Iraq and Afghanistan and in Libya. They sponsored terrorist organizations that are splinters of Taliban, ISIL, Al-Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda, and Jaish al-Islam, and Falak al-Rahman, and the White Helmets, which is the new invention by the British intelligence. The monster she spoke of destroys and occupies and sends its troops everywhere in the world for thousands of miles to destabilize and to threaten international peace and security. The monster is an American monster that so far refuses to destroy its chemical arsenal. The United States has refused and continues to refuse to destroy its arsenal, but they would lecture others and give sermons on the destruction of chemical weapons. Mr. President, my colleague from the French delegation said that he was horrified by the pictures he saw. But he wasn't horrified by pictures of hundreds of civilians that French airplanes killed in Minbij in 2016. 200 civilians killed, entire families killed by the warplanes of France. The ambassador from France did not see those pictures, and they were not a source of horror for him. The word double standards is an understatement in itself for those people. Mr. President, in response to the web of lies by some Western states against my country, against the backdrop of the alleged use of chemical weapons in Douma on April 7, 2018, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates in the Syrian Arab Republic today, on the 10th of March 2018, has sent an official invitation to the OPCW to dispatch a fact-finding mission to visit Douma and investigate the allegations on the alleged use of chemical weapons in Douma, and to establish the facts on these allegations. I did inform you of this yesterday in this very chamber. The Syrian Arab Republic welcomes the visit of the FFM, and it stands ready to fully cooperate and provide all forms of assistance for this mission, undertaking its functions and guarantees the safety of its members, and it will facilitate the interviewing, sampling in accordance with the terms of reference. We look forward to the FFM undertaking its work in transparency and professionalism and reliance on credible, tangible evidence. And if it actually reaches the locations, it will reach a Douma that is liberated, and they will be able to have full access to any location they wish to visit. Mr. President, the situation is quite clear. The co-sponsors of the U.S. draft resolution do not seek the truth, because simply it will condemn them and their terrorist proxies on the ground. Instead of waiting for the FFM of the OPCW and establishing whether toxic chemicals were used in Douma, instead of this, they table draft resolutions that do not enjoy consensus and do not seek the truth. It just seeks to establish mechanisms that have no objectivity and preempts the results that supports their political accusations and agenda. And they are aware that cloning the gym would not be accepted by the states that truly seek in this council to establish the truth on who uses toxic chemicals against Syrian civilians in this regard. I reaffirm that the U.S., Britain, and France did make the gym a failure, and they are the ones who thwarted its work, as they insisted on politicizing its work, and they did bring pressure to bear on its leadership, and they did stop being professional and credible, and they issued fabricated reports that accuse us based on open sources that include the white helmets, and false testimonies and fabricated evidence that finds its source in terrorist groups, most important of which Al-Nusra Front and the White Helmets, which are a British-hatched media arm of Al-Nusra Front. Mr. President, this scenario is similar to the scenario we witnessed a year ago when the United States of America launched a wanton aggression on Al-Shayrat Air Base based on weak arguments and pretexts that we have used chemical weapons in Khan Sheikhoun. These were proven false when the U.S. and its allies prevented the experts of the gym from visiting Khan Sheikhoun, and they prevented them from taking samples from the military base we just referred to. Things are crystal clear. The aggression of the U.S. and its accomplices thrives across history on lying, misleading, and hegemony, and on the rule of the powerful. It is a brutal approach that does not respect the rule of law and does not give weight to international legitimacy. My country, Syria, for 7 years and to date, is a case in point for their appetite for lies, misleading, and fallacies of the United States and Britain in this very chamber. what they did actually to destroy Iraq under the pretext of a big lie, which is weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And I'm compelled this time and every time to remind you of the position of the former Foreign Secretary Colin Powell when he, in this room, and I was there, and I was actually in the seat of the Deputy PR of China. Colin Powell did showcase tapes, documents, pictures and maps that we found out later that they are fabricated by the CIA to serve the agenda of invading Iraq, which was prepared in advance at the time. And the same thing happened with Libya. And you need to know a bitter truth. This world, throughout centuries, have seen different eras of occupation and hegemony, and they sought to loot the wealth of the nations or occupy land or impose geopolitical agenda. However, the political immorality reached a new low as they destroyed Libya and killed its people to cover up for a case of bribery and financial corruption that implicates the head of a member state that is permanent member state of this council that says it upholds democracy and freedom. And they have imposed on oil exporting countries to pay the bills of the continued aggression and military intervention. This is an affair between those who are corrupt and have the money and those who are mercenaries and have weapons and power. Today, some permanent members are launching an aggression on countries with sovereignty just to cover up for their domestic crises and the conflict between their political elite. Mr. President, we in Syria, after 7 years of a filthy terrorist war that was imposed upon us, we believe that the choices are clear and they are a big challenge on this council, so that the council would stand up against such lies and this political failure that the US, Britain and France are trying to implicate the council in and drag it towards it. It's your decision today, and the international public opinion, your peoples and peoples of the free world will be your judge as you exercise your responsibilities towards upholding international legitimacy and the maintenance of international peace and security and protecting the world against dark terrorism that is used and exploited by these three countries to undermine the stability of states and their self-determination. I call upon you to uphold the multilateral political system and order that believes in the right of people to self-determination and rejecting political security and economic hegemony. The Syrian Arab Republic reiterates its condemnation in the strongest terms of any use of chemical weapons by any party under any circumstance and everywhere. We stand ready to cooperate with the OPCW to uncover the lies promoted by some Western parties to justify their aggression and in service of their political goals. We can see their ships in the Eastern Mediterranean, and they were waiting for the V2 to start their aggression. I would like to say to those Western parties, and they need to listen to me attentively, your threat of aggression, your maneuvers, your lies, your terrorism would never derail us as one of the founding states of this organization from exercising our right and fulfilling our duties in accordance with our national constitution and the charter to protect our sovereignty and territorial integrity and to fend off any aggression from any source. And we will not allow anyone, permanent member or non-permanent member, to do to us what they did to Iraq and Libya. I thank you, Mr. President.
Up next, a press conference held Wednesday by Russia's Lieutenant General Viktor Poznikir, First Deputy Chief of the General Staff's main operational department of the Russian Defense Ministry, speaking about the situation in Syria.
Good afternoon. The armed forces of the Russian Federation and the Syrian government have finalized a major humanitarian operation in Damascus suburb of Eastern Ghouta. During this operation, 100,000 people have been evacuated, including 20,396 militants and 38,000 of their family members. Right now, we are finalizing the evacuation of militants from the suburb of Duma. This is the final town that they are leaving. Over the past 24 hours, there have been no military provocations, no hostilities, no shelling. Overall, the Russian Reconciliation Center and the Syrian Army forces evacuated 41,000 people, including 3,000 militants and 8,000 of their family members. We continue to ensure that hostages are released. According to the latest deal, Jaish al-Islam group released 195 hostages. Starting from tomorrow, to ensure law and order and to provide assistance to the local people, the Russian military police will enter the suburb of Duma. The people of Eastern Ghouta are provided with the necessary humanitarian aid by the UN and by the Russian Reconciliation Center. As part of this mission, three humanitarian convoys by the UN have delivered 445 tons of basic necessities. The Russian military supplied 418 tons of food, 8,000 blankets, and more than 400,000 food packages. The Syrian government has embarked on a major effort to restore civil infrastructure in Eastern Ghouta. Overall, Eastern Ghouta seems to go back to normal. Refugees continue to come back to the settlements. About 60,000 people have come back to their homes. Russia's and Syria's success in fighting terrorism have not been perceived in a good way by some of the forces. There have been attempts to stage provocations, including nerve gases, to implicate the Syrian government. The Syrian government and the Russian Reconciliation Center identified those provocations beforehand, and we've informed the media and the international community in advance. On the 3rd of March, we identified a workshop where terrorists put nerve gas into artillery shells in one of the bunkers. The terrorists have not been able to stage any chemical attack against the civilian population. That's why on the 7th of April, there was allegedly the last attempt to fabricate the news that the Syrian army used gas in Eastern Ghouta. The White Helmets imitated once again an alleged attack against the people of Duma. The representatives of these pseudo-organizations have staged these provocations in several areas in Syria. They've used children, including babies, for their provocations.
The
international community is aware of the video footage of those rehearsals. On the 9th of April, the day after the alleged chemical attack, the town of Duma was inspected by Russian chemical biological experts and paramedics. They came to the scene and taken samples of soil and traces of a possible nerve agent, but the analysis identified that there have been no chloride chemicals used and no toxic agents. Now, they visited the hospital that was shown by the White Helmets. They've interviewed doctors and wounded people that are there, but there have been no evidence that any chemical attack took place. The militants that are leaving the Duma are not aware of any wounded or injured or victims of a chemical attack. There is only one hospital there, and Russian experts went in there, and they've been given notice that no people with signs of a chemical attack were taken to the hospital. They have not seen any bodies that were victims of a chemical attack either, and the doctors are not aware of any burial places of those alleged bodies and victims. The World Health Organization's Peter Salome said that there are 500 people who were wounded in that gas attack. We contacted the Syrian Red Cross office, who are active, taking active part in a humanitarian operation. We asked them to locate those wounded people, but they have not have any information on the location of those wounded people, of those victims. If the World Health Organization really wants to learn more about it, we invite them to Eastern Ghouta, and we're ready to provide guarantees of their safety. Back in 2015, the World Health Organization, as part of humanitarian operation in Aleppo, made multiple statements that the situation there is catastrophic, that there are no medicines. But following the liberation of Aleppo, the terrorists' depots and storages were brimful of Western-produced medical equipment and drugs supplied by the World Health Organization. Following that, the World Health Organization has not produced any statements. We believe this is a reckless statement, irresponsible statement. Such statements discredit this organization and also provoke a new confrontation. Unlike the World Health Organization, the OPCW took an official decision to send an official mission to the town of Duma to hold an objective investigation. On our behalf, we reaffirm our commitment to providing full guarantees and security to OPCW experts and provide all the necessary conditions for their inspection. Despite the attempts by evil forces to disrupt Russia's efforts to stabilize the situation in Syria, this work continues. Near the towns of Abu Dhur, 9,111 people returned to the province of Idlib. Thanks to the efforts by the Russian Reconciliation Center, the civilian infrastructure is being restored in the province of Deir ez-Zor. Since December, 37,000 people have returned to their homes. And yesterday, in the city of Deir ez-Zor, a bridge has been built and commissioned. Now, once this bridge is used, it will be possible to deliver more humanitarian aid to the western side of the Euphrates River. The Russian Reconciliation Center continues to settle the conflict and end the hostilities across the entire Syria. 2,511 settlements have joined the ceasefire deal. 234 requests were sent on the ceasefire by local military commanders. We are very much concerned over the situation in the city of Raqqa, where there is a serious threat in terms of hygiene. Instead of making threats on striking Syria, the U.S. should have turned their attention to Raqqa. We know that there's several ships that are heading towards the Syrian territory. The U.S. Navy are moving towards Syria, and they are likely to come there by the early May. We'll continue to keep you updated. Thank you for your attention.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.